You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 9:59 a.m. Next up is American Standoff with Jacqueline Keeler.
Jacqueline Keeler, and I am your host today for this newest episode of American Standoff. We started January 6, 2022, a year after the armed insurrection, really, at the Capitol in Washington, D.C. And this show seeks to examine the current political divide in America from an Indigenous perspective, given by myself, Jacqueline Keeler, a Native journalist based here in Oregon. And over a year ago on January, so, you know, as I mentioned, the show basically has been examining the fallout from January 6, 2021, and also, you know, some of the, looking particularly at the things that sort of led to it as well. And of course, we have another hearing today happening this evening. We'll probably go over that next week. But I think this week we are going to be looking at something that may seem a little bit out of our wheelhouse, but I think it's actually really a really great way to illustrate a certain idea, right? And so we're looking at Europe's deadly heat wave and the DNA of colonialism. My regular listeners may know that in my book Standoff, which examines the very differing responses to standoffs that occurred in 2016, the Bundy armed takeover of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge here in Oregon, and the Dakota Access Pipeline protests north of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, North Dakota. And the origins of those two standoffs are very different. And in my book, I really examine the colonial origin story, and I contrast that with the Native nation's origin story. I think the two have very different elements, and I call these algorithms. These different elements and how they work together to create outcomes. And I think the colonial origin story, which I have noted many times, is I view America as still a colony, right? I gave this lecture how the U.S. is still a colony. And the colonial origin story is really based in this concept of occupying other people's lands. I see this, and certainly I believe that Standing Rock made the military nature of the occupation of our homelands, of Native nations' homelands, visible to the world. A lot of people didn't read it that way, but that's how I saw it. And because the tribe was attempting, the Standing Rock Sioux tribe and other Dakota Lakota tribes were attempting to assert elements of their treaty and doing it in a very peaceful way. And this was viewed as a huge threat and basically garnered a near militarized response. And so But you will notice that the demands of a colonist, which I view the Bundys as basically acting upon their rights as colonists to the land and its resources, that it has a much more measured response. And so you can see them coming and leaving the wildlife refuge and you know, carrying guns and everything. And so So I'm going to take a deeper dive into this. And you know, you may wonder, how can that colonial story apply to Europe when they are obviously in their own homeland? And I will get into that. I believe that the algorithm of colonialism, which leads to the outcome of climate change, is what they're presently experiencing. And these countries are wealthy, many of them, because they were beneficiaries of the wealth that was sent back from the colonies. And so I'll get into more detail on all that, but that's sort of the working idea right now. I think I wrote a little more succinctly here in my script. It says, how Europe faces forest fires and record-breaking temperatures. Consequences of climate change must be seen as a direct consequence of the consumption-oriented DNA of colonialism, quote-unquote, progress, right? So on the show, you know, every week we examine the connections between seemingly disparate events like the fires in Europe and the heat wave and its origins in white supremacy and the DNA of colonialism it exemplifies. And so, and the ongoing occupation of indigenous homelands in the United States that it facilitates. So my name is Jacqueline Keeler and I'm your host. This is the Call-In Show. So don't be shy. Please do call in. The number here is 503-231-8187. So let me see. Here we go. Today we are going to discuss the European heat wave, climate change, and its colonial DNA. Once a rare occurrence, extreme fires are now becoming more frequent and lasting longer worldwide. We certainly have experienced that here in Oregon as well. The destructive blazes are driven at least in part by climate change, which exacerbates their scale and intensity, even in the northern winter months. So with temperatures in Europe right now are reaching, they're actually exceeding in many places 40 degrees Celsius, which doesn't sound like a lot to us here in the States with the Fahrenheit, but it actually comes out to 104 degrees Fahrenheit, which is unheard of in Europe. I mean, here in the United States, we have become more accustomed to them. In certain regions, it's you know, in Phoenix and places like that, it's sort of the norm. But with wildfires raging across several countries in Europe, this is now prompting mass evacuations and so of the wildfires. But so the heat wave isn't helping. Wildfires are spreading across Europe as a combination of heat waves and droughts that are making it hard to combat the blazes in some regions. On Wednesday, emergency services battled wildfires across southern Europe while these evacuations are ongoing. And so firefighters are continuing to battle wildfires in Greece, Spain, and Italy. On Thursday, the European Forest Fire Information System said 19 countries were in extreme danger from the wildfires, while Spain, Portugal, and France were at very extreme danger. So let's listen to a brief overview of the extreme weather Europe has been facing.
Is suffering through its own heat wave while wildfires are raging in several countries amid historic high temperatures. Will Reeve is in London after a record-setting day.
The mayor of London said yesterday was the busiest day for the London Fire Brigade since World War II when the city was under attack. Fires breaking out around London as the city was besieged, this time by record temperatures as much of Europe battles heat and fire.
Overnight, wildfires burning across Europe. Fires in the UK intensified by extreme heat. London stifled by record-breaking temperatures, a high of 104.4 degrees Fahrenheit, the hottest day ever in Britain. Outside London, the town of Wennington set ablaze. Houses completely consumed by flames, engulfed in smoke. Hundreds of firefighters desperately battling to save what they can as people are forced to evacuate. The mayor of London tweeting, "This is critical. London Fire Brigade is under immense pressure. Please be safe." UK officials issuing the first ever red warning.
The extreme heat we're forecasting right now is absolutely unprecedented.
In a country where air conditioning is a rare luxury and homes are often built to retain heat, many of those who did go outside sought refuge where they could. More than 37,000 evacuations in France since last week, 5,000 in Greece. Across Europe, more than 1,500 heat-related deaths. In Spain, wind gusts spreading fire, fire planes dumping water on houses. A spokesperson for the governor of Spain calling the fires a real environmental tragedy.
A welcome respite has arrived here in the UK. A fresh rain in London last night bringing temperatures down and helping those firefighters. But elsewhere in Europe, some countries expecting 90 to 100 degree heat to last this week and maybe into next.
So that's a very short sort of overview of what they're facing in Europe right now. I just looked up, what percentage of homes in Europe, in the United Kingdom, have air conditioners. And this is sort of an old data, but in 2008, they estimated about 0.5% of UK homes had any form of built-in air conditioning. And that is contrast with the more than 100 million homes in the U.S. that have air conditioning. That's a brief look there at that. Good morning. This is American Standoff. We're a live talk radio show, so please do call in. The number here is 503-231-8187, and I'm Jacqueline Keeler, your host. And I always like to start off the show by greeting you in my own language. My name is Jacqueline Keeler. And so in the Navajo way, we also introduce ourselves through our clans. My clan is Kia'ani Nishle, and I am born for the Yankton Sioux people. My father's people are the Yankton Dakota Sioux, Yihaktawan Dakota. So, Yihaktawan Dakota Bashin. So, I'd also like to acknowledge that we, what we now call Portland, Oregon, is located on the ancestral lands of the Multnomah, Wasco, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Cowlitz bands of Chinook, Tualatin, Kayapuya, Malala, and many other tribes. So, the question I ask every episode, the top of every episode of American Standoff, is that in the more than going on a year and a half now that has passed since January 6, 2021, what have we all learned? I mean, we all sat there and watched the live footage of the Capitol of the United States being stormed by mostly white Americans, many who were armed. And with the hearings going on right now, we've gotten a lot more detail about what happened and how it impacted the people that were there and also our democracy. So I would love to hear how you feel about that question. So we open with a recent heat wave and fires Europe is facing right now, and you may wonder, as the title of the show asserts, that how does this relate to colonial origin stories? And so as I briefly began to mention the origin stories of a people, So as I mentioned, I view the United States as still the colony, an in function, if not overstated form, right? So it claims to be a country, but I really do see it as a colony. And you can tell this by the way it acts and the decisions it makes and its relationship to the land and to the original people of the land as well. And by people, I mean it in the indigenous way, which is, all the people, the four-legged, two-legged, the winged ones, the green growing things, those that swim in the water, all of those beings are people in our way of thinking, and not just resources or sort of things that need to be pushed out of the way, right, to gain access to resources. It's this perspective of colonialism that I think is driving the issue of climate change. It's this sort of extractive, resource-driven perspective. And although these European countries, some of them didn't have colonies, but many did, and these old colonial powers, so they basically profited from this system of colonialism and extraction and have been the primary beneficiaries. I think that some studies have shown that for every person in the world to have the standard of living of developed countries, as they're called, and I put that in quotation marks, it would require like 5 Earths. Right, more resources than this one Earth can have. So the level of sort of resource extraction that is flowing to these countries is not sustainable for everyone on Earth. right? And so, the countries that are affected right now include, as we mentioned, Greece, Portugal, Spain, Italy, Turkey, the United Kingdom, and France. And in Greece, a wildfire in the mountains near Athens is forcing hundreds of people to flee. Although it has now been brought under control, the wildfire that broke out on Tuesday, some 16 miles north of the capital, spread to urban districts. So it's quite a lot what's going on. I mean, I'm looking at this whole list, the place of Spain, of course, many of you have been hearing about that, driven by record-breaking heat wave. A fire that started last month in the province was more scorched at least 61,000 acres, 25,000 hectares. More than 6,000 people were evacuated from 32 villages in the area, and two people have died and three critically injured. So that's just a brief. There's many more things. Portugal, of course, 14,800 acres have burned. And actually, the country's Director General of Health said that there were 1,063 heat-related deaths between July 7th and July 18th. So these heat waves have happened before in Europe. I mean, 2003, 2006, and I think the final figures from 2003 were like 70,000 people died. Once they kind of really examined the records, so that is something that these deaths are a lot. Let's listen to more about why this heat wave is so devastating in Europe. 100 degrees may seem normal to us here, but it's not there.
Why is it so hard for Europe to deal with a heat wave? We may not like it, but Houston is pretty used to triple-digit heat. Those temperatures are wreaking havoc across the pond, though. Rail lines are shut down over concerns the tracks will bend. A tarmac at an airport melted, halting flights, and wildfires broke out in England and France. The extreme heat is also taking a real human toll as residents struggle with these unprecedented temperatures. So why is it so much worse for our European counterparts? A big reason we can deal with 100 degrees and hotter in Texas comes down to two words: air conditioning. Europe doesn't have the same infrastructure to handle the heat. Very few homes or public buildings have air conditioning, and it would be wildly expensive to change that. Here in Houston, even if you don't have air conditioning, there are places you can go to hide from the heat. The other problem in Europe is homes and buildings aren't built for excessive heat, they're built for excessive cold. That means the structures are designed to trap the heat, not release it, and indoor temperatures soar. Also, cities aren't designed for heat, so there's less concern about shade, green spaces, and public spaces for swimming. All that makes it hard for Europeans to keep cool.
So that's a brief overview at why it's more difficult for Europe to deal with the heat wave than we have here. Once again, this is American Standoff. We're a live talk radio show, so please do call in. The number is 503-231-817. And you know, this air conditioning, as far as a solution to a climate change, carbon emission-based problem, is hardly a solution, is it? So here we have a continent, Europe, where previously they didn't require air conditioning to exist, and now suddenly they may need air conditioning, and so that's going to put a much greater carbon load carbon emission load on the world. So and the U.S. I was looking at data over the presence of air conditioning in U.S. homes, and it has substantially increased since the 70s. It has increased a lot. We're now at almost 95% of U.S. homes having air conditioning. That was from 46% in 1976, and then 63% in 1980, and now 95% in 2020. So that is quite shocking. What is the carbon load on that? And so estimated that the results in 100 million tons of carbon dioxide being released into the atmosphere each year. So, and you, I was very alarmed. I visited Phoenix recently. I went back up to the Navajo Nation, and I was shocked to hear that Phoenix is one of the largest, has experienced the most growth of any urban area. And of course, Phoenix, you can't exist there without air conditioning, and it's just getting hotter and hotter and hotter. I don't understand how people live there, honestly. And yet, so many Americans during the pandemic flocked to Phoenix and just added more and more to the carbon weight. My next book is going to be about the impacts of uranium mining on Indian country, particularly looking at the impacts it had on my on the Navajo Nation, the Navajo and Hopi Nations in northern Arizona, and certainly my own grandfather, who was a uranium miner, and then my grandmother's family, who lived in Black Mesa, which is where the strip mining was taking place there, and so my traditional Navajo family, Diné family, have been impacted by the extractive resources that were needed to grow both Phoenix and Las Vegas, including the coal power plants that are placed there in the Four Corners region, which, even though they are now no longer operational, you can still see a methane cloud from space above the Navajo Nation. And so it's certainly my people have paid a huge price for the development and this sort of lifestyle, right? So let's listen to some more in-depth coverage of the climate change-induced crisis Europe is facing, and pay attention to the number 1.5 here.
Europe is sweltering in an extreme heat wave. The temperatures and high winds are stoking massive wildfires across several countries, and scientists say these extraordinary events highlight the already very real consequences of global warming. Blazes have destroyed property and vast stretches of forest in France, Spain, and Portugal, Italy, and Greece. Hundreds of people have died in the record-breaking heat, and forecasters warn there's little prospect of any respite. The UK is not known for hot weather, but this week is proving exceptional. Huge crowds are heading to the beaches, despite travel networks also feeling the heat.
In Britain, average temperatures in July are in the 20s Celsius. Anything approaching 30 counts as a heat wave. With the mercury now nearing 40, an extreme heat warning is in place, even for the north of England. Forecasters say on Tuesday, the UK's all-time record of 38.7 could be surpassed.
To be honest, as a meteorologist, to see the brutality of the heat that we're expecting tomorrow is quite astounding. And it does worry me a lot, and my colleagues here in the Met Office, that this sort of unprecedented heat could be a regular occurrence by the end of the century.
Britons are not used to extreme heat. Health experts are reminding people that extreme heat can be dangerous.
We have that balance where we might not see very much good weather and we want to enjoy it, but we're talking about temperatures that we've not experienced in this country ever, never mind for a long time. Our bodies, our houses, our culture, our way of life is just not geared up for it.
Train operators have lowered speed limits, fearing the heat could warp rails.
This is due to severe weather.
And that's disrupting services.
So, for instance, if you're going from London to Leeds today, after midday, rather than 2.5 hours, you're looking at a 5-hour journey.
It looks like I might not get back to Crewe today because of the heat, and I won't get back tomorrow. No trains tomorrow.
Now, Europe's heat wave has brought added urgency to international climate talks currently taking place here in Berlin. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is urging rich countries to keep their promises to help poorer nations deal with global warming and its consequences.
They are here to build trust, the foreign ministers of Germany and Egypt. The two countries are co-hosting the 2-day climate conference to prepare for the next big UN climate summit in November. Germany's Annalena Baerbock says countries need to redouble their efforts to hit climate targets.
The climate crisis does not stop at any border, and the climate crisis is now the biggest security threat to all people on this earth. So we will only be able to tackle it together. Because the climate crisis does not stop at any border, the response to it must not either. We must intensify our joint efforts.
Intensivieren.
Officials from 40 countries gathered for the summit to discuss staying focused on fighting the increasing impacts of climate change. Addressing the conference in a video message, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres urged rich nations to keep their pledges to supply funds to countries hardest hit by the climate crisis.
Excellencies, this has to be the decade of decisive climate action. That means trust, multilateralism, and collaboration. We have a choice, collective action or collective suicide. It is in our hands.
Well, yeah, many people are now questioning whether richer countries are actually being serious about their pledge that the era of fossil fuels is over because, you know, Germany is extending its coal power uses. It's also investing in LNG terminals, etc. So Germany's Chancellor Scholz today said that Germany and Egypt will work together closely to develop green hydrogen.
Let's look at this with Sonja Siniferatne. She's one of Switzerland's leading climate scientists and a professor at the country's Federal Institute of Technology. She's been lead author on many international reports on global warming and joins us from Vienna. Welcome to DW, Professor. Will this heat in Europe that we're calling extreme today be normal in a few years?
Yes, definitely. Already now, heat waves have become more intense and more frequent, and this is going to continue to increase with increasing global warming.
Now, the Paris Climate Agreement saw world leaders pledge to limit global warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius. So where are we heading right now?
Well, at the moment, we are really not on track. So basically, if we continue on the same way that we are doing right now, we would reach about 2.4 degrees. So basically, we would be above the limit that was set within the Paris Agreement. If we want to limit global warming within the bounds that were set in the Paris Agreement, and if possible to 1.5 degree, we would need to have CO2 emissions until 2030, so very quickly.
Okay. Given what is happening now, that's unlikely to happen, isn't it? We have the war in Ukraine prompting countries like Germany to reactivate old coal-fired power plants. How much of a setback is this renewed interest in fossil fuels?
Yes, this is certainly a problem. I think it depends basically how long this is happening for. So for instance, if it's just basically this year, because we are in a transition phase, while also, of course, we have less gas available, then it could be okay. But if we were to be using coal for several years, then it's going to be to have really serious consequences on the climate.
That was a longer he's done by Deutsche Welle, I think DW, which is a German news outlet, and I love going to them for different things. They're quite a good in-depth reporting. So, you know, I think the issue of 1.5% has really, been under assault with the Trump administration withdrawing from the Paris Agreement. And then now with Trump's buddy Putin starting a war and basically showing how dependent Europe is on Russia for natural gas and oil. And so it basically has destabilized any sort of measures that have been agreed upon multilaterally to address this issue, and so how it's going to be resolved in the future is really in doubt. I think I believe we'll be seeing more of this of the extreme weather.
Who's the caller?
Oh, okay, great.
Lee.
Oh, hello, caller.
Hi, it's Lee. As always, thank you for your intelligence and your willingness to speak truth to power. What I want to say is that long ago, well, maybe a decade ago, I found a book called Red Alert, Saving the Planet with Indigenous Knowledge by Daniel Wildcat. And It continues to amaze me that people in the civilized world refuse to listen to indigenous people. And for my part of it, I have to apologize, but damn, I'm trying.
It's hard because what we're trying to address are systems.
Say that again.
Because what we are trying to address are systems.
Yes.
And systems are much harder to fight, you know. When we are, that's sort of why I want to analyze it at this level, because I think we could actually come up with some things that are useful and in ways in which we can fight it. And I do think it involves, as I detail in my book, Standoff, sort of a third way, finding another sort of algorithm that, if not marries the two, gives a pathway forward. I think we need to rethink our relationship to the land, and the American relationship is based in colonialism, and so I think that is what really needs to be addressed. Right now, it's dressed up in stories, particularly I do a deep dive into the origins of the Revolutionary War, stories that are basically propaganda, and don't give us any answers that we can work with. And so it ends up being used by very right-winged armed militia groups instead.
Yeah, well, I think that Wildcat, pointed that out in the book, is that the paradigm that we have now isn't working and it has to be changed. But it's also patently absurd to assume that we're going to go back to the lifestyle technology of tribal nations peoples before the invasion, because those cultures no longer exist, unfortunately, but the environments in which they lived in no longer exist.
Well, this is very interesting. I didn't mean to cut you off, but the next next audio I'm going to play actually looks exactly at what you're describing, which is your Native nations still exist, and we still are finding ways forward to live on the land and understand our situation, and as we find ourselves in 2022. And so I'm going to focus. I was originally going to look at the 2020 Oregon wildlife season, which is one of the most destructive on record in the state of Oregon, and which burned, I think, more than 1 million acres, right, of land. And it also left the air unbreathable. It seems like we've sort of forgotten that.
I just buried a dog. I'm downwind from that fire. I buried a dog with lung cancer. Earlier this year, because of the inhalation of the small carbon particulate matter. So,
and I wonder.
Keep working on.
Thank you so much. Yeah, and I wonder how it impacted wildlife as well, breathing in that. And so, but I'm going to focus right now on the Klamath Water Standoff, and I also like to thank our caller that has been ongoing for more than 20 years in Southern Oregon, because this standoff, it did become a Bundy-led standoff during a few years ago, but it starkly illustrates the contrast between a colonial and indigenous origin story and its outcomes. So let's listen to the audio of that.
The machine did not kick anybody off any piece of ground for his own benefit. I wasn't the one that was in here physically killing them and moving them and taking them off their land. The fish is the only way the tribes can get retribution on the white man. 20 years ago, it was the same story.
8,000 of us here in the park. There's 5,000 more on Main Street.
In 2001, another severe drought threatened the fish. When the government shut off the water, thousands of farmers packed the streets of Klamath Falls, symbolically moving water into the irrigation canals.
He will pass it to his son, John, and then to his grandson, James.
They called it the Bucket Brigade.
I was in seventh grade. Everybody was there. We were united.
As tensions rose, members of the Klamath tribes faced harassment in town. Under pressure, federal officials turned the water back on later that summer.
Federal government caved and gave us our water.
But the victory for farmers was a disaster downstream. 34,000 salmon washed ashore dead. Taking water from the lake during a severe drought had unleashed an epidemic of fish disease.
Wow, sorry about that. It seems like a lot of the audio that I originally meant to use got cut off. I should have double-checked that before I sent it off. But yeah, the original piece audio I was going to do originally was supposed to include a really nice long intro describing the Klamath tribe's relationship to the salmon. And so that didn't make it into somehow. I must have actually deleted that part of it. But what I loved about that intro, and I do recommend listening to that, so from a Vice News report, and you can find it on YouTube. The title of it is the title is about how climate change is exposing the racism behind an Oregon water war, right? And they have a tribal member that's talking about we have no more time to waste. We're on fire. We're covered in a blanket of smoke. The whole West is in drought. 2021, a summer of record breaking heat and extreme drought across the American West. And they go to a dry field in Oregon's Klamath Basin, and where the fields are running dry because the federal government has shut off water to farmers. And this is because the Klamath tribe has preeminent rights because it's the oldest user of water. And this has been decided by many court cases. And the farmers were actually invited to come there about 1900 by the federal government and given all these promises from the federal government if they would farm this reclaimed, quote unquote, reclaimed land, right? And then with the termination, which was a policy in the 1950s and 60s, up until when Nixon stopped it in 1970, which was the federal government sought to terminate tribes and to reduce make them not exist as political entities anymore, and at which point many tribes faced taxation of their lands, and some states would back tax them all the way back to the founding of the state, bankrupting them, and then having access to the land. As I've mentioned in previous shows, Oregon had the most terminated tribes in the nation, and this was largely driven by a desire for tribes' forest and access to the lumber, the timber in those forests. And so you see here once again how extractive focused colonial perspective based in an origin story that dictates the consumption and extractive use of resources. And look at even the language I'm using here. It's so alien and foreign to an indigenous perspective. As I've noted in previous episodes, and I go into detail in my book, I use a simple definition of a native people, and I just call them a people, because in many of our languages, we call ourselves the people, right, with a capital P. And so a people have their origin story in a meeting with a sacred being who is a manifestation of the land itself. And in this meeting, agreements are made, and not only with the land, but with all the people that are already on the land. And as I mentioned, people doesn't just refer to human people, but all the other living people. The four-leggeds and the winged ones and the green growing things and the water too. You know, it all has a right, and it all is part of our agreement to being part of that landscape. And it's for a specific area, usually bounded you know, like the Great Plains, or for my mother's people in the Southwest, between the four sacred mountains and the four sacred rivers, that's the Dinata, the Dinipakaya. And so within the context of the space, we are a people. We are made a people by our relationship to the land and agreements we have made with the land and the spirit of the land. And for my father's people, of course, that is the white buffalo calf woman who came bringing the pipe to us. And at which point, when we accepted that and we made those promises with her and with the Buffalo Nation, we at that point became Dakota and Lakota. We became a people. And this, before that, we were something else, as my Lama used to like to say, but then we became those people. And so we are defined by our relationship to the land. So, like when we saw the coal mining, the strip coal mining at Black Mesa Mountain on the Navajo Nation, where my grandmother's family is from, you know, you saw elders saying that we have no word in Diné, in the Navajo language, for being relocated. It just means to disappear, to die. And so this is the way in which you see the cultural difference and also the origin story, which is an encapsulated sense of functions and sort of, you know, I compare it sometimes to if-then statements that create outcomes and perspectives and relationships, right? And so I think that I like to look at things at the structural level because I believe that it really helps us understand, sort of begin to take apart how this happens. So, you know, I'm not a Native person who's just trying to do a guilt trip on white people. I'm giving a constructive analysis that can be utilized to find a real workable pathway. And that's my goal, right? And I'm seeing the ways in which these are different, how they operate differently, how they create outcomes. And so I think you see that, internationally, when you're looking at what's happening in Europe, you know, they went from being focused to their relationship to their own lands, right? And I've gone to, I go into some depth into Anglo-Saxon common law in my book Standoff because I found that the Bundys, who are of English descent, really referenced, particularly Clive and Bundy, referenced English common law quite a bit, in addition to the Constitution and these things. But that's really part of how they understand their relationship as a people is the old system of English common law, but trying to transpose that to a colonial project in a vast continent that's far larger than England, right? And so I think when the people lost their contact with the land, and to a certain extent that was taken from the English people fairly early, in 1066, as I've mentioned many times before, when William the Conqueror, a Norman, great grandson of Vikings, right, who had gotten part of northern France to stop marauding the French king, crossed over to the British Isles and basically conquered the English. And at which point the English were a landless people, right? Because all the land was owned by a foreigner, right? And so that sort of landlessness and so the importance of the commons, these small parts of the land that were still available to the ordinary people to farm their little strip of land, crops and or to go and harvest, sticks of wood and stuff like that to make baskets or to graze their one cow on was a subsistence level of existence that English people had for, 1,000 years. And which was systemically taken away from them through the Enclosure Acts that happened over a couple hundred years and enriched the wealthy who could afford to build fences around things and then dispossessed the poor who couldn't afford to fence in their one little strip of land where they planted crops, right? And so so this is sort of looking at, I like to take a broader view of how things work, because I think when you pull out but you also look with much more detail. You begin to really see how things function, how things happen. Like, we're overwhelmed right now by the prospect of climate change and the way in which it's really ramping up these issues. And then the prospect also of these sort of authoritarian regimes and also authoritarian wannabe elements in our own society. I think I mentioned last time that CPAC had part of their conference in Hungary in admiration for the authoritarian takeover there, and the way in which authoritarian figures like Putin are creating worldwide instability, and in this instability able to really shuffle aside more thoughtful reactions to climate change and these issues that are facing and threatening probably over a billion people in this world with climate change, migration, changing. I know that part of the reason why Europe is getting so hot is because of the change in the jet stream, and it's bringing these hot air from Africa to Europe. I mean, Europe is at the same latitude as Canada, northern Canada, and yet it has a very different very temperate environment, and this is due to the jet stream. They don't know what's going to happen with climate change, how that's going to alter that and possibly make these areas less livable, and so not livable in the same way. But yeah, it's so you see in which these wealthy countries that have profited from colonialism are now facing more expenses to maintain a lifestyle which is not possible for most of the people on Earth, and yet still owing something to all those billions of people who do not have access to the lifestyle they have, and are basically facing I think they're calling it a climate change induced expense or something like that. But yeah, so that's looking at it at with the Klamath River Basin. I really wanted to show how the tribe's relationship, which has lasted for a millennia. And the destruction of the salmon, which we always hear about, but I think we don't really contend with, in a real way, and what that means. And one of the quotes in that Vice News piece was one of a tribe member saying that our creation story tells us that if the fish die, the people die. And she says, before that happens, we'll fight because it's in our blood. And the fish, of course, are facing extinction there. And so, and of course, the demands of white farmers who think that these things are been guaranteed them by a colonial occupation is of course, the issue. And you hear the younger farmer there saying that he didn't dispossess anyone of his land, yet he's sitting there, his whole life is based on land that was taken, right? So I think that one of the chambers also says it was uncomfortable hearing this repeated sense of entitlement from a fifth generation farmer, sixth generation farmer, that their grandfathers told them there would always be water at the time. I remember thinking, well, that's the problem. Your grandfathers told you there would always be water, but my dad was telling me we got to throw these fish back because there's not enough. So by having this relationship to the salmon, and having it define them as a people, the Klamath Nation is able to really observe and understand the ways in which the impacts of this extractive colonial occupation, what it's really doing. And Native nations' sort of ways of living on the land have a long track record because, of course, they took place over thousands of years. And of course, with the farmers, you're looking at, maybe 150 years. Right, and in some cases, and so there's not a long track record, but this is a sustainable life. This is actually potentially possible to maintain for any long time period, and so I think that's something that they really need to grapple with, and so I think the young man that they were interviewing, so his family's been there for 117 years, right, and so looking at the looking at that element of it, so how are we, like I mentioned that, you know, the authoritarian leaning folks are sort of really looking at these ways in which, maybe I should do an episode about authoritarianism and the attraction it has for certain people. And I believe it is partly people who are, who have been socialized that way. And so that does go back to the historical, elements of feudalism in European culture. And, you know, although we don't live under a feudal government now, and they, there are elements of it that are retained in our culture. You see the Bundy still carrying ideas from the English Civil War, right, before they emigrated to North Carolina as Quakers. These ideas remain sort of a part of how a family understands itself, right? And so the natural inclination of Europeans and other folks who have had long thousands of years of experience with feudal governments is something that I think I'd like to take a much closer look at, particularly as CPAC is actually holding conferences in Hungary in celebration of exactly such a thing happening. And so, so I'd like to maybe look at the, I have another audio, which hopefully is longer and is the whole, which looks at the issue of, you know, the response that the Republicans in our own state legislature, like, if, how are we going to change these things? And often it seems like at the federal level, it's really hard to get changed because the Senate, and I think I'm going to do an episode to looking at a deep dive in the Senate as well. But the, you know, with the filibuster issue, we can't get things moving through there to deal with these issues. We just saw, heard, Senator Manchin, a Democrat from West Virginia, basically put the kibosh on a whole plan there that came out recently, and so how are we going to do it at the state level? And so I think a lot of you remember what happened a few years ago when our own in 2019, our own Republican senators left the state and fled to Idaho. So let's play that audio now.
Off after 11 Republican lawmakers fled the Capitol Thursday to avoid voting on landmark climate change bill. Some are believed to be hiding out in Idaho. In an unbelievable turn of events, threats of violence from right-wing militias supporting the rogue Republican legislators then led the remaining lawmakers in the Capitol to shut down the state Capitol building in Salem. It's now been nearly a week since all of Oregon's Republican senators went into hiding to prevent voting on the bill, which aims to decrease emissions by implementing a statewide cap-and-trade model. Without at least two of the rogue Republican senators present, Oregon Democrats, who control both the state Senate and House of Representatives, don't have the necessary quorum to vote on the legislation. Oregon Democratic Governor Kate Brown sent out the state police to track down the senators last week, but they have not returned to the Capitol. This is Oregon Republican Senator Brian Boquist, one of the lawmakers who fled the Capitol, speaking last week before the standoff began.
Sending the threat out like, oh, we're going to have a special session or I'm going to send the state police to arrest you. Well, I'm quotable. So here's the quote. This is what I told the superintendent. Send bachelors and come heavily armed. I'm not going to be a political prisoner in the state of Oregon. It's just that simple.
That was Oregon Republican State Senator Brian Boquist saying send bachelors and come heavily armed. Well, Oregon Governor Kate Brown said Monday she won't negotiate with the lawmakers until they return to the Capitol. For more, we go to Portland, Oregon, where we're joined by Oregon Democratic State Representative Karen Power. She's co-chair of the state's Joint Committee on Carbon Reduction and co-sponsor of the Cap and Trade Bill. Welcome to Democracy Now! What is going on in your state? Republican legislators, some have fled to Idaho, and you've got the far-right militias threatening the state capitol, so it was shut down this weekend?
Yes, and our Democratic leadership in both the House and the Senate issued a statement last week condemning any threats of violence towards our state police and comments that would make our state capitol unsafe.
But explain what is going on. So they're in Idaho, and how did far-right militias threaten the state capitol?
So earlier in session, the Senate Republicans walked out on their job to halt progress on passing a really significant landmark education funding bill as well. We have underfunded our schools in Oregon for about 20 years. When they walked out, our governor and the Senate Democratic leadership negotiated two bills that didn't move forward this session in exchange for their return to business for the rest of session. Now they've walked out again less than just a few weeks later. And I think the clip that you played earlier from Senator Boquist perhaps led to some of these militia groups stepping in to presumably defend our senators who are now out of state.
Talk about the climate change legislation you're pushing for.
Yeah, this is all over our climate bill. We've been working to study carbon pricing for the last almost a decade. Over the last couple years, we've been working intensely on a cap and trade bill to align with California, Quebec, formerly Ontario, along the Western Climate Initiative. For the last 8 months, I've been helping to lead a terrific committee of both Republicans and Democrats as we've traveled the state to hear from citizens. It's coalesced into a final version of the bill that was going to be voted on by the Senate last Thursday when the Republicans walked out denying them quorum. It's really just incredibly disappointing that with the climate crisis before us, we were unable to take this last step and get it to our governor's desk.
Okay, I thought there was a little bit more to that. It seems to have been cut off. But yeah, that was 2 years, or I think it was in 2019 that they walked off and refused to, right before the pandemic, and refused to vote on that that climate change bill, which I know a lot of people who work on the issue of climate change here in Oregon who opposed that bill because they didn't believe that the cap and trade thing was a great model to use. And so I'm not supporting that, but I'm just showing by replaying that, that was actually from Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, just the extent to which even in a blue state like Oregon, how difficult it is then to get movement on any real legislation on this, and the extent to which Republicans are willing to go to prevent that sort of thing from even a vote happening. And I should actually mention, I forgot to mention this, but a couple days ago, on July 19th, a federal appeals court on Monday, upheld a 15-year plan for several drought-stricken wildlife refuges along the Oregon and California border against challenges by agribusiness and conservation groups, including climate in the climate area. So that is still a stalemate ongoing there. But there's, I'm bringing it down to the local state level just to show the way in which even in a place like this, it's really hard to get movement and the entrenched interests of people who are acting under a self ideation of themselves, which comes out of a colonial origin story. The colonial DNA is profound, and when I often talk about the Senate and the issue there about the rural voter having so much more say than any other voter in this country, particularly those in urban areas. That is deeply tied to that colonial past, because who was given the land? It was white colonists who were given the land, and so they had a bit of the spoils. And so when we look at the voting across, the nation, we definitely see that these white rural voters have given tremendous amount of power, far exceeding that of voters on the coasts, and who tend to be more racially diverse and ethnically diverse. And as I pointed out in previous shows, and I'll use the same example again, which is if you look at South and North Dakota, here you're looking at two states which were once part of the Dakota Territory and the Great Sioux Nation and other nations. It has less than 2 million people, both of those states together, and yet they have 4 senators, right? Each state has 2 senators. Well, you look at the state of California, which has 44 million people, and they have 2 just two, like half the number of senators. And so as you can see in the way in which the balance of power is really given to these rural white voters, and many of them who have this historic connection to the dispersion of Indian land given to white settlers and are still holding it five, six generations later. And so so I just really wanted to show kind of, so you were looking at what's happening in Europe, but it has ties here too, and international ties when you're considering also the impact of Putin's aggression as well, destabilizing any progress that has been made to try to address the issue in a measured way, and the issue of climate change. And we're almost at the end of time here. I really wanted to thank you for listening, if you have been listening, I think it's really important to understand the structure of colonialism and how it impacts things, and to recognize the United States is a colony, and then the impact on colonial powers back in their own homelands in Europe, how that is playing out there, and unless we look at these things in a structural manner, we won't really understand how to change them. And that's all I have to say this week.